Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the summertime season 2023, and the reading is easy. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing some of the sessions from the 2021 HNSA conference. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000. Divided between the adult and CYA categories. In this session, Richard Lee, founder of the Historical Novel Society, joins international best-selling authors Ben Cain and Colin Falconer.
So welcome to everybody who's here live with us. Thank you for coming. Welcome also to those of you who are watching on Catch Up. I gather this is going to be available for a month or so. I'm hugely privileged to be here and to welcome you today. The reason I'm presenting is because 24 years ago, I set up in a fit of madness the Historical Novel Society. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that we would ever have an Australasian conference. And I think I'd even have been more shocked when I set it up if you said that I'll be talking. I'm actually, you see behind me, it's a fine thing. I'm not at home at the moment. I'm in Prague and on holiday, but that I'll be talking over the internet to Australia live. It's just, it's boggling and it's wonderful. Anyway, we're here today to discuss epic historical fiction, which has been a form of historical fiction since the very beginning and has always been popular, but always reinvents itself in new ways. And I'm introducing to you two spectacularly good practitioners in the genre. So the one thing I could have predicted 24 years ago when I set up the society was that I'd be able to talk to some fabulous authors in the genre. In a sense, the HNS was set up for readers to meet their heroes in literature, and for people who were wanting to learn to write, to learn from the very best. And I think we have two of the best of this genre here with us now. So without further ado, I'm going to let them do some talking. Ben, if you'd like to introduce yourself, Ben Cain.
Thanks, Richard. And thank you, everybody, for coming. Hi again, Colin. Nice to see you.
Hi, Ben.
So I am, in no particular order, an Irishman, an ex-veterinary surgeon, and a novelist, and I have just had my 16th novel come out a couple of weeks ago, and mostly my novels are set in ancient Rome, but I have the first two parts of a medieval trilogy out as well, and I love my job. It's far better than being a vet. I live for history, and like Richard said, being able to do talks with people all around the world is really fantastic. So hopefully everybody, you'll enjoy this talk. Thank you.
And Colin.
Yes, Colin Falconer. Again, like Ben, rapt to be here and thanks for coming along. I've been writing epic historical fiction for around 30 years now. I covered all periods of time and from all over the world. From 300 BC and Alexander the Great through to Cleopatra and the Silk Road in the 13th century, the Ottoman Turks. My latest book is set in Morocco in 1890. So I do cover quite a wide range rather than, I'm not a specialist in time and place. My hallmarks I hope to give a strong sense of time and place and a sweeping adventure and with a good dose of humour in there as well. So that's what I do. And I, like Ben, I just love it.
So that's fantastic. What I thought I would do, obviously not everybody who's watching will have read your latest books and what have you. What I thought would be a good way to start is if we ask which way, for what reasons you choose a particular time period, whether it's to do with the sources, the setting, or whatever. Particularly interested with you, Ben, because as you said before, you've done pre-imperial Rome, you've done post-imperial Rome, and you've made yourself a, you know, Sunday Times bestseller in that. And now you're writing about Richard the Lionheart. And I know from that, Richard the Lionheart, maybe because I'm called Richard, I don't know, but I've always been fascinated by him, thereby by the Crusades. So I've read a lot of the source material, and I've actually made a sort of project of buying every piece of historical fiction that features Richard, just to see how differently it's portrayed. So I wondered whether when you approach this, I presume you haven't read all the other historical fiction, which, you know, varies by decade as to the impression of Richard that they bring. But also, what drew you to the Crusades and Richard in the first place?
Well, it's a good question, because I was getting a name, sort of the man who just writes about Rome. And that's partly because my publishers just, when it ain't broke, don't fix it. Publishers are quite conservative, I assume, all around the world. So they were very happy for me to continue writing Roman stuff. But I moved publishers a few years ago, and, you know, there were conversations about writing different time periods. And I want to state, I've always been interested in all aspects of history. You know, I'm not just someone who's obsessed by ancient Rome. So I always wanted to write about different time periods. And then it was this move to this new publisher. They were very keen. In fact, the contract stipulated I had to write a non-Roman book. So the time period, you know, there were lots of contenders for it. Among them, the Hundred Years' War, Richard the Lionheart. I mean, I do want to write a series set in Ireland in the early 20th century. But when I mentioned Richard the Lionheart, my editor's eyes lit up. So, you know, there, like you mentioned, there have been plenty of historical novels about him, but not a huge number in the last 20 odd years. Sharon K. Penman would be one. And she writes a different style to the type of historical fiction I write. So he seemed like a real larger than life figure. He really was. And I had strong impressions of him from a book called Night Crusader by a man called Ronald Welsh, who wrote children's historical fiction, although they read very well as an adult. And so I'd always had an image of him in my head and of that period in general. So I started researching him, and it very quickly became apparent that, you know, the story was there, this huge sweeping story with this massive family that quarreled among itself, and his mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine, one of the most prominent women of medieval history, and his father, you know, who was a very able man as well. And then his Richard's clash with the King of France, Philippe Capet, who was a very devious character, I think it's fair to say. And then, you know, the whole crusade and his war with Philippe and his own brother John and so on. It's just screaming out to be written down in a story. So that's what I got on with doing. And once I got stuck into it, I just got more and more enthusiastic, as I'm sure, you know, anyone who's invested in a project that's interesting does. You want to keep doing it.
Yeah, again, there is, as I was saying, there's fantastic source material for that. One thing that particularly interested me with you, Ben, with this is that your first book is, I've read three of your books, but I haven't read the first book, is about a lost legion in China. Is that right?
So, yeah, well, they got beaten in sort of modern day Southeast Turkey / Iran, and they ended up in Turkmenistan, and then possibly may have reached China. Yeah.
Yeah, but the interesting contrast with that is that there can't be very much source material for that. So in a sense, where you started off, you were thinking, I'm going to write this fiction into a blank. And this is not, I mean, I'm like I think all of us are very broadly interested in history, very broadly interested. So I've read I've visited many places in the Roman world, and I always go to a Roman museum when I can. But I hadn't heard that particular bit. So you're taking an outlying bit of history there. And the contrast with what you're doing now is it's, you know, this is one of, I mean, the Crusades, one of the things that's remarkable about them is people thought at the time, they thought they were hugely important. So they recorded everything about them. They're one of the best recorded things. And one of the things that fascinates me about your book is that you stick close to the source material. So do you think as a writer that you've moved from, as it were, again, as a writer, I always feel, well, they'll know, the reader will know this, so I need to find something new. But actually, readers don't know the solid source material. Do you think you've moved in that way as a writer, or is that just happenstance because of this particular project?
No, I have got closer and closer to the sources. It has always frustrated me from the very start with that first novel where, you know, the reference to China is literally a half a paragraph. And sometimes with Roman sources, you literally might have a line that refers to an entire war. So getting to write medieval period, I mean, there are three Christian and two Muslim sources of the crusade that Richard led. And in many cases, there are instances that occurred that were written by both sides. So they are true because those men never met each other. But to me, it was literally a complete joy to find this source material. So I've always tried to stick closely to history. It's just that with Roman history, you often don't know what it is. So I quite like that approach. It's a real pleasure because, as you say, most readers don't have a clue. You know, it's a rare email, like from someone like you or someone else. I'll sometimes get one from an academic or a retired academic who says, "I love the way you stuck so closely to the history." But most readers don't have a clue. They just want a good story, and you know, the facts do make a good story.
Yeah, in that case, they do. I mean, I interviewed Bernard Cornwell just as he'd finished writing his book, Stonehenge. And I said, you know, this is fantastic. Is this a new place you're going? And he said, no, I'm never going anywhere prehistory again, because I had to make up everything. You don't realize how much of the background world that if you're, you know, he literally had to create communities and everything. So again, anyone who's thinking of writing, you know, the next Clan of the Cave Bear or everything, it's worth thinking about that.
It's interesting, if I can go in on that point. I was doing a chat salon this morning on ancient history, and there was a professor there. He was an expert in ancient history, which was a bit intimidating. But he said, I love reading ancient historical fiction to see how novelists can deal with creating a world out of so little source material. Because he said there really isn't much to work with. And he even sets his students, it's one of their assignments, to read historical fiction novels and to see how it might be done.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Again, my son's just studying for his A-levels, and one of the A-levels he's taken is ancient history, and another one he's taken is history. You won't be surprised at that. But the difference from reading Thucydides or Herodotus, where they're the sole resource, as it were, and they're backed up with a bit of archaeology, and then dealing with, you know, the history of the Cold War or the Vietnam War, such a totally different subject. And as a writer, your imaginative process approaching that has to be totally different, I think. Anyway, Colin, good to you've written about, again, I've not read all of yours either, but you've written about the ancient period as well as about the one that's set in Marrakesh and the Atlas Mountains now.
Yeah.
Your choices of subject, although there seems to be possibly an interest in Islam that passes through it, I don't know, but yours are broader even than Ben's. So how do you come across your source materials, choose your subjects?
I think it's largely accidental. I with Colossus, it was actually a publisher who said to me, I wonder what would have happened if Alexander hadn't died. What would have happened next? And it's my only foray into alternative history. It was an interesting project because you still have to learn so much about Alexander and the whole period. It's just you then extend it a little bit way forward into what might have happened. And I discovered that Alexander did have plans. We know what those plans were, what he wanted to do, and that he was going to invade Carthage, and he had laid out the plans to do it. With the Morocco book, I suppose I think when I was 19, I went. I remember riding into Marrakesh on the back of a motorbike, with the sun just coming up and the walls pink, and I'm thinking to myself, I'd only just left school. I would love to write about this one day. And anyway, fast forward quite a few years. I was in Morocco, and our guide was telling us about two Spanish artillery officers who signed up for the Sultan's army in the hope of making some easy money. And he said, no one knows what happened to them. And then we walked to the top of the Casbah Eight Benadoun, which is where they shot some of Game of Thrones. I think some of the famous Khaleesi scenes were shot there. The film studios for Gladiator and all that are just down the road. So it's quite an iconic place to go. And we stood at the top, and he said, oh, look, if you look down there, there's the salt road to Timbuktu, and there's the Atlas Mountains behind us. And there were these people he was a Berber. He said, there were the Berber warlords who ruled this place, and they actually ruled Morocco, not the Sultan, because nothing could happen because the trade couldn't come in or out of Africa without their okay. And then he started telling me the stories of some of the lords of the Atlas. And by the time, an hour later, when I came down the mountain, when I was, as the sun was setting, I had my story on Morocco many decades later. And that's how that one came about.
That's another thing I was going to say. I've always thought that people read historical fiction, obviously, for the history, and we've talked about the history, but also it's exotic. It's a way of making familiar places exotic, but it's also a way of making exotic places come nearer, and the travel element something else, isn't it? Particularly if you have, I think when we were talking earlier, Colin, you said that you had a kind of extreme experience when you were in the Atlas, when you went back recently.
I suppose when you think of, or when I used to thought of Morocco, and especially after I went there the first time, it was just very, very hot. I couldn't imagine how cold it would be in the desert. My wife got quite sick there, and she was shaking so hard on the back of a camel with the cold that we had to stop the camel and get her off. And she did get very, you just can't imagine getting it's just that so cold in any place that you get sick from it, especially in a place that's deserts and with deserts and camels. And it gave me a different slant on the story, and it became a part of the story. The when they got trapped in the Atlas Mountains in the snow, which is actually a true event. This is what happened to the Sultan's army when he went across the Atlas to take on a rebel army. When he came back, if it wasn't for one of the Berber warlords, the whole him and his whole army would have died in the snow. And you don't imagine that happening in Morocco. So it became a feature of the story, and I knew what it felt like.
Unintentional, I guess, though.
Yes, unintentional. I really wouldn't want to go through that experience again. It was a nightmare. But
suffering for your art and suffering for your art.
And your wife suffering for your art as well.
Well, that's probably a better way of putting it. Yeah, so I don't come out of that looking too heroic.
Yeah, again, we visited Marrakesh. We've been once, and we stayed mostly in the souks, and that was fabulous, mind-bending experience for me. I always find it fascinating whenever I go outside Christendom. But then we took a trip into the mountains, and it was like going two seasons away. There was still snow to be seen. It was in March, I think we went, 1st of April. And it's just such a land of contrasts. And I could I wasn't struck with a novel, but I was struck with the absolute beauty of the place.
Yeah.
So, Ben, again, I think in your biog you say that you've visited 50 or so countries traveling. It's obviously a passion of yours as a young man. And I also read, followed your blog where you were going to the Holy Land to research about the Richard novel, where it's based in the Holy Land. How much do you find that travel informs what you write? Because again, you've done some great travelogues, or that you can get these on YouTube about, is it Lake Trasimene and the Punic Wars and what have you. How much do you, I mean, I hesitate to say, I mean, every writer of historical fiction probably likes the research and the travel as much as the writing, I think. But how much does the travel inform the writing for you? Or is it a necessary corollary of the writing?
I think it is. I used to beat myself up about going on research trips. Indeed, there was a while where I could have afforded. So initially, when I was first published, I couldn't afford to do them particularly, and I had young kids. And then I could afford them, but I didn't go on them because I couldn't justify it to myself, because I thought, surely I can do it with textbooks and visiting museums in the UK or whatever. But eventually I started doing them. And I mean, they essentially, I'm sorry, everybody, you know, they really do feel like a holiday, even though they're work. I've learned not to go on about them too much when I'm doing talks or on Facebook with my readers, because people do get annoyed. And I say, well, it's not my fault that it feels like going to Italy and driving around the route that Spartacus took and visiting, you know, places where he may have been, and going to the original Via Appia and so on. That's what I would do on holiday anyway. It's what I've always done all my life. Now I get paid to do it. Yes, it's very important for me, and we mentioned this in the dry run we had. I think Colin agreed that I'm not always certain that everything I see or do when I go on a research trip gets into the novel that I'm about to write. But what it certainly does is it helps me to feel that I'm in the place when I'm writing about it. So I don't necessarily, you know, have this huge set of notes that I'm referring to describe a place. But I've got an image in my head of the place. So, for example, when I was in Israel, retracing the route that Richard took with his army south from Acre along the coast before he was going to cut inland to Jerusalem. You know, that's it's a busy road nowadays. But, you know, I could mark the terrain and visit a Crusader castle that was contemporary with the time. And I've been in deserts before. And we've got all those rich sources. So, you know, when you mix them all together, they helped to shape the book, but it definitely helped and does help to go to places that are in my books. So what do you think, Colin?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I do get a bit of kickback from friends when I say I'm going on a research trip. They just, you know, some snigger behind their hands, and I think other people want to slap me. I love traveling, so it's something I must admit, when I came to write Silk Road, it's because I wanted to go along the Silk Road, and the story came a little bit later. There are things like the incidents I mentioned in Morocco that you give you something, an extra something, when you come to write about the book that you couldn't get any other way. I mean, yeah, I think I have done one book without actually, you know, going to all the places that I would like to have gone to, but I always felt. I felt I was cheating, and I probably wasn't, because you can get it. As Ben says, you can do it, but there's always something that you can, that can add to it. The other thing I think about writing, going to the place, you can only go so far with the research. You're then trying to close your eyes and imagine what it would have been like maybe 200, 400, 500 years before. And that's something that I don't know whether it's essential or not, but I love to do it sometimes, just close my eyes and go, try and imagine the scene as it used to be.
Again, I'm actually writing a book about the ancient city of Antioch at the moment. And because that's on the Syrian border, I've not been able to visit yet. It's just in Turkey, but it's close to where all the fighting's happened. But what I have been able to do is look at people's travel videos on YouTube. You know, if you put Antakya, which is the modern name for it, onto YouTube, and you can see quite a lot of tours around the place. But it's a fascinating city because obviously it was a city that was founded by one of Alexander's generals. Then it becomes a prominent Greek city. Then it becomes a prominent Roman city. It's one of the first cities of Christianity. Both Peter and Paul were there. It then becomes a city that's fortified by Justinian. And then it falls to the first run of the Arab conquests, the Muslim conquests. And then it's reconquered by the Byzantines. And they hold it for the period up to the First Crusade, which is what I'm writing about. And there are eyewitness accounts from, there's a spectacular bit of archaeology done in the Roman city. And then there are eyewitness accounts from the time that it was an Arab city and from the time that it was a Byzantine city and from the time that it was a Christian city when it's taken after the Crusades. The point I'm coming to is that almost none of the landmarks, I mean, obviously the topographical landmarks are still the same, but there are no buildings hardly that survive from this period at all. The place was laid waste by Baibars in the 13th century. And it's also a place that's that has earthquakes. So I'm wondering now whether if I were actually to go to Antakya, whether I mean, I'd get some idea of where the river is and how big the river is. I know that. I'd walk up the hill. There's a little bit of the Christian fort remaining, the Crusader fort remaining, and there's a little bit of the walls. But essentially, a lot of what we're doing in historical fiction is actually one of the best people at writing landscape and buildings is J.R.R. Tolkien. And obviously none of the things he describes is actually as it is. It's in a way, it's him imagining in Minas Tirith, he's imagining possibly a big Byzantine town, possibly somewhere like Antioch actually. And when he's, yeah. So how much do you bring, as it were, your fantasy? Once you've seen stuff, how much do you invest things with what I would call a fantasy imagination? Because we're doing time travel, aren't we? We're doing, taking some of the, someone's, our readers to somewhere that they no longer can go. Do any of you approach it in that way, or are you just? I always feel that when you're, even particularly with older history, whenever you, the fragments that remain of the records are only fragmentary. Most of the records have disappeared, and the same of the building. So if you fixate too much on what you can actually see, then you're failing to imagine the stuff that you should be imagining. Is that a fair way of putting things?
That's a fair way of putting things. I think it is at the end of the day, we're writing novels. So the book it has to be invested with imagination. If sometimes I think you put things in places in a certain way, or you describe them in a certain way that fits the tone of the novel. I'm thinking of, when I wrote Lord of the Atlas, there was an incredible amount of first eyewitness accounts of what Morocco looked like in the 19th century. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, those English nobility, they'd get hire a put on a pith helmet, hire a donkey, go, okay, I'll see you in 3 months, and head off into the scrub. And then if they survived, they would come home and write a book about it and get it published. So that I had to stop in the end. All these lords and everything writing about it. So there was a wealth of material. But also when I came to write it, I wanted to also to colour what they had seen. I would pick and choose because it has to fit the colour. It's a novel, and I was fitting the colour of the novel and making, getting the tone right. So I think... There's when you read, say, a novel like Game of Thrones, there's not much difference from historical fiction in the tone of it, I think.
I'm researching a time period much more modern than I've written before, and I don't want to say what it is yet, but this extra wealth of material that Colin's referring to, I'm becoming aware of it. And I haven't yet found too much of it that I have to set it aside. But I mean, there are things that I'm a veterinary surgeon by training. But when you read something that's written down by a man who did something, so there's this horse that is so savage that nobody else can ride it. And it had literally killed a man. And so, I'm surprised it hadn't been shot, but because of the time we're talking about. But it was a valuable, really good horse. So this chap bought it to see if he could tame it. And his groom, when it went for him, he had a freshly roasted leg of lamb, which he rammed into the horse's mouth as it tried to bite him. I know, bizarre. But this horse obviously got a mouthful of hot lamb and was there and stopped trying to bite him and was then really quiet and quiescent around this groom. So the guy that had bought it did the same thing a couple of days later with a leg of lamb. And then he was able to ride it. But when he was in battle, it would literally tear people's, you know, it would literally attack soldiers and kill them and hurt them and so on. And I was reading this going, this is marvelous. So this guy is going to have a horse that kills his enemies because it had, but it's nice to him because it had a leg of lamb shoved in its mouth. I mean, who would ever have thought it possible? But it's written down there in black and white. So
well, there you go. Psychology of horse. Yeah. Again, so I think we've probably annoyed the audience enough saying how much we enjoy the travel and how much we enjoy the research.
Yeah.
So can I move it now into the novel writing things? One thing I noticed about both of your most recent novels is they start with your heroes, possibly using reprehensible behavior that they will feel a level of guilt about through the rest of the novel. It's a point that you both have. Colin, your novel starts in seamy streets in London, and your hero, who though he'd previously won a VC, is on the edges of becoming down and out. And Ben, you start with your hero needing to clear up a little area of his past and perhaps not choosing the most cleanly way of doing that. So we know about the history, we all love the history. Let's try and learn from you how you move into the novelist process. How do you find the places to start your novels and how to motivate them through? Colin, if you'd like to.
Yeah, you use various motivations in characters when I've been writing. There's in Harem, it was revenge. In Stigmata, it was someone trying to save his son. But I think there's something in the redemptive story that probably sparks with me. I mean, I've had my ups and downs in life, and so it sparked something in me. For me, the story or the journey that these guys go on is the plot and the excitement element. But the inner journey that they go on is what gives the novel its meaning and its resonance, I guess. So there's two journeys taking place at once, and that's how I see it as a novelist. If it was just the journey, it would mean nothing, but it's in parallel with what the characters are experiencing. And I did like the idea of someone going on a journey where someone who's seeking self-destruction, where all around him he has invitations to take up that invitation, and finally finding a reason to want to stay alive and want to keep going. And I found something really, really appealing in that story, and that's what I came down the mountain with in my mind. I'll work with that. That's something that I think would appeal to a reader as well as appeal to me if I've got to be sitting here for 12 months writing this.
So it's a really, really strong draw in your novel. The other thing that I really enjoyed was the friendship, quite understated friendship. I think Colin, you said in your introduction that you like to use a bit of humour, and One of the things I really enjoyed about your novel is the banter between the characters, and this way that you you avoid making it obvious. The person who's going to be redeemed doesn't want redemption and makes funny jokes, casting it away at what have you. How did you come across? I mean, obviously you enjoy writing the friendship thing, but how does that dynamic work for you? Do all your novels feature a friendship like that, or?
They usually, yes, I think, that's a good question, Richard. I'm thinking, going over in my head, yes, mostly they do. An unusual friendship sometimes. This one, I suppose, it's two guys who are thrown together, or one seeks the other out to help him. The banter that comes off is fairly it's fairly natural for me. I don't have I like writing dialogue, and fortunately I have a really great editor with a very thick red pen who pairs it right down, and I'm pleased to hear you say that it comes off as sort of not minimalist. I can't remember the word you use, but it's not overdone. And that's because I've got this really great red pen that goes through it. I can overwrite the dialogue, and then I'm left with the good stuff. But I find it fairly easy to write. I don't know why, but it just comes to me. Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Ben?
I'll say it immediately that it's been a really big learning curve for me from my first novels, when I was tremendously excited just to be published, because I had a career for, 16 years as a vet, and then to become a full-time novelist. And it was sort of, oh, now I'm just going to write lots of battle scenes. And obviously there's far more to a novel than a battle scene. And indeed, occasionally now, I don't look at them very often, but if I look at my Amazon reviews and sometimes my more recent novels, there's not enough fighting in them, we'll say, a poor review. And my answer to that, which, I don't make on Amazon, obviously, but here is, I've got bored of writing just battle scenes. It's far more interesting to write about the characters. And so character development has been something that I've worked on, for many years, but I'm constantly improving on. And like Colin was saying, this journey of the individual within the story is crucial to the story, because the reader has got to be invested in the character. And if the original, or sort of the character, is flawless, so my first heroes could be accused perhaps of being, not having any bad side to them. But as my first editor used to say to me, the thing that makes a character likable and that people can relate to is when they have a weakness. Because we all, we all have bad sides or weaknesses. And she said, an enemy that people will like is an enemy that can do a kindness to somebody. He's not just this cardboard cutout villain. And so I always, it sounds quite stereotypical, but you can approach a novel in a very matter-of-fact way. It's a good idea to have the character conflicted in some way. And I mean, in this novel, which is the one you were mentioning, I'll just, shamelessly plug it there and put it in front of it. That's Crusader. And so the hero's done something which was actually, in self-defense in the first book, but doesn't look good. And in order to stop his situation being threatened, he does something. And because he's essentially a decent person, he's then tortured by that for the rest of the novel. And this was in the Crusades and in Europe at the time, it was a deeply, deeply religious world. And sin was something that everybody lived with much more than they might in the Western secular world now. And so when you've got something on your conscience, it's really not a good thing. So I tried to just have that whole balance of, he's going on a holy war, so maybe he could expiate his sins by doing that. Hopefully made it convincing. So it's much more fun actually spending a lot more time invested in that, because I can do the battle scenes and hopefully vivid depictions of the world that I'm writing about quite well. I don't have to think that much about it, but I actually enjoy the whole character development. That's a hugely important part of the novel now. But it has been a very a very, you know, not a steep, well, a steep learning curve initially, but it's still a learning curve. You know, I still literally, I'm listening to Colin, what he's saying. Any novelist I ever meet or books I read, I mean, I just mine people for information because, you know, I'm going to be learning about writing until I die. You know, I'm very much a workman author as opposed to, you know, well, I don't know whether I've got a natural flair, but certainly most of my flairs come from hard work.
So I think, yeah, I would say, Ben, that you do have if it's not conscious, then you do have a natural flair for story. I'm interested, again, to those who haven't read these books, one of the, again, to mention, to compare with what I say with Colin, there's a friendship that's growing between your main character, who's an Irish guy who's been orphaned in terrible circumstances, and the king, King Richard. But obviously it's a bit like the Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII relationship. It's unequal. So there's always a sense that the king will eventually be a king. And you juxtapose that with the relationship that Ferdy has with Rhys particularly, but also with his other friends in the Mesni or Mini or whatever that follow Richard. And so the arc of the first story is not a redemptive one. It's a sort of like, this is a poor Irish guy who's getting beaten up and finds friends, and then it finds that the bad guys are not necessarily bad, and finds a hero, as it were, in Richard. And then the second one is, in order to protect his role there in that happy position that he finds himself in, even though he also feels he's betraying his Irish roots with being there, he has to do something that's reprehensible to prove himself, to protect himself rather. But then what I liked about that is that, as you were saying, it moves into the moral sphere, because any novel about the Crusades is going to have an element of the moral sphere about it. And so it becomes the small story. His sense of guilt is mirrored by Richard's sense of guilt. And then you lead into the whole idea of what it is for, you know, what might have motivated Richard to go on crusade. So again, was that conscious at all, or was that just, I think there's a scene you have where Richard's enacting some penance, and it's fairly extreme.
Yeah, it was, you know, he stripped himself naked and lay on, this is an attested scene, that he stripped himself naked and lay on the floor of a chapel in February, I think it was. And was repenting his sins. This is King Richard. And the scene, I was writing that, and actually then I thought, oh, this is a great chance for my hero to feel real guilt, because here's the king, you know, his master doing this, and he's got a murder on his conscience. So, yeah, I did. That was happy chance, actually. I just thought, well, this will be really preying on his mind as he's standing outside on guard while the king is inside repenting. And so one of the, you know, one of the religious, one of the bishops is got quite a beady eye, is quite observant, and notices that the hero is feeling or looking a bit shifty, and basically sort of winkles it out of him what he did, gets him to make his confession, and so on. So sometimes scenes just, you know, literally come out of nowhere. I'd love to say I had that all planned, but I didn't.
This does happen a lot, actually. You know, you meet the author that you love, and you find a scene that you particularly moves you, and it's the author. I don't think authors always know what they're bringing together, because they're living in the scene, aren't they? And they're living in the research, and they're living with the characters. You obviously had that insight into your character Ferdy, which is so human. But you weren't. It wasn't set up. It's just something that happened in the writing. You were writing a different scene. I find that fascinating, I have to say. I'm just going to have a little look. I'm supposed to be doing chairman-y things, and I'm going to see if there are any questions here.
There were a couple that I've answered.
Colin,
they're not in the chat on the side. They're in the Q&A.
Yeah, there's a Q&A. There's only a couple of questions. Well, that's great, because I'm really enjoying this. So let's continue. One of the things I was really wanting, again, you both mentioned sort of violence. Ben, you said that possibly when you started there was a little too much violence and battle in the balance in your novels. How do you, again, one of the things I find most difficult when you're dealing particularly with soldiers, there's this, you have to show them behaving basically in a way that, that's savage. You're involved with the savagery of life, inevitably. One of the things I've thought about writing about Richard myself, Ben, and one of the things I couldn't cope with was that mode of warfare that he employed in France, which was basically go and trash the neighborhood of everybody to inflict economic damage on the people who own the land. And, you know, that sort of, later it becomes called chevauchée, I think, which is the, riding through the landscape, foraging, taking all the goods. And then that forces the people. How do you deal with, the difficult moments of battle, difficult moments where your character is forced to do something that we, sitting in our living rooms, never are forced into the situation of doing?
I think I'll turn this over to Colin fairly quickly, but I think that basically once a battle starts, anyone is fighting for their life and they're fighting for their comrades. They're trying to not to be killed and they're trying to save their friends, which is something that I've heard time and again from veterans or serving soldiers. Well, what do you think, Colin?
Well, I've been reflecting on this, Richard, since you floated that question in the email earlier. And I realized that a lot of my views on battle scenes are formed by my father. My old man was at D-Day, right? And I remember he was a man of few words, but the things he did say always struck a chord, maybe because they were so few, struck a chord with me. But he was always, it was his, like I asked him once what D-Day was like. He said, son, I was seasick. He said, after 4 days, I just wanted to get on the beach and I didn't care if they shot me because I'm feeling so ill. And he said, all I remember is sitting, beating a can of beans on the beach as the sun came up and, what did he say? Thinking that would be the last time I ever see the sunrise. And then I got in the tank and that was it. That was my D-Day. And the way he talked about war, I mean, to me, he was heroic. He didn't think so. He said, look, I was terrified the whole time. I just went through things. And I think some of my characters do see it that way. I try and get that point of view, their view, they don't see the whole battle. They just see what's affecting them. And it was almost a laconic way of describing things. And he managed to somehow convey the horror of war to me without ever actually being too graphic. He had this pair of binoculars that he got, Zeiss binoculars. And I said, where'd you get them from? He said, I got them out of a German tank. I said, I asked him the story. He said, there was this tank, German tank. It had a direct hit. He said, I climbed in and he said, I saw the binoculars, took them, but I never got in a tank, one of those things again. I said, why not? He said, well, the German crew, or what was left was a German crew, were inside the tank. And like I could picture what he was talking about and I got his sense of horror just from that. Now, he wasn't being very descriptive, if you like, or gore, but it was all formed in my mind. And I suppose I try to do that. My descriptions of battles are often filtered through how I would hear him describe it. Put it that way. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating to hear. Again, I did notice that in both your books, there's a famous book on writing called, I think, Save the Cat. Is that Save the Cat? Does not
Save
the Cat.
Yeah.
And it's effectively the rationale behind it is that if you, in order to make your character flawed, as you mentioned earlier, Ben, that you need to do, characters have to have flaws. You often start in a place where they're, frankly unattractive, and then you have to tell the reader some reason why they should be rooting for this person who they think is, yeah. Like your hero Harry is quite self-indulgent at the start of your novel, Colin. You have to have a reason to root for them, and this the joke is that you get them to save the cat. And I noticed that there are two moments in your, a moment in each of your novels. One is where your novel, Colin, is about the mad caper of taking some out-of-date guns into totally inappropriate countryside, mountains, and then firing them at fairly defenseless places, which is why they want the guns in the first place. Lo and behold, they fire the gun and it levels everything. And then in the sack of the city that happens, you get that sense of remorse where they have a moment of kindness, generosity, humanity. And with Ben, obviously the one that you knew you had to tackle at the start of this novel was the massacre that Richard instructs of the Muslim, of the Arabic prisoners. The situation is that the city of Acre surrenders, and they let a lot of people free, but they take 3,000 captives of people who they think are worth a ransom. And Saladin agrees to a ransom, and then Saladin doesn't produce the ransom, and possibly never intended to produce the ransom, so that Richard would have an army at the back of him, would have all this business of having to feed 3,000 warriors, and couldn't advance to Jerusalem anyway. Historically, as is attested on both sides, Richard orders the massacre of these people, and it's his knights who go in and do it. And you choose that moment to send your, you know, firstly, Richard gives your hero the chance to refuse this task, but he feels he can't refuse it. So he goes in and partakes in the massacre, which is an interesting decision in and of itself. But in the midst of it, he finds a way, as it were, to redeem himself, or to certainly to redeem himself in the idea of the thoughts of the reader. And again, are those things that you consciously set up because you realise that the perhaps going beyond what's enjoyable?
I sometimes really feel put on the spot in situations like this, and people ask me, did I plan on this? I tried to think about it from the point of view of if I was in a situation like that, and there was a horrific massacre in Russia in World War II, or it was either Eastern Poland or Russia, where there were essentially German reserve. They were policemen, and they were men in their 40s and 50s, and they were being charged with policing areas under German occupation, and in some cases shooting Jews. And this commander, it's a famous incident. The commander lined up his men and he told them that he'd been ordered to kill, you know, the 600 or 700 Jewish people, and obviously utterly horrific. And he said, we've been given orders to kill them, and I find this distasteful, but I'm going to do my duty. But if any of you don't wish to take part, I give you my word, you can stand aside and you will not be punished for this. And he had, of his unit, 10% didn't take part and 90% did. And they were all, you know, they weren't young Nazis. They were guys in their 40s and 50s, like I said. And so it's really, oh my goodness, why did they do that? And it was possibly because everyone else is doing it, so I'd better do it too. And so I had that in my head, and then I'm trying to remember why he did what he did during the massacre. But I think it was probably just a human reaction that if you didn't have to do 100% of the violence, if you could do 90% of it, that's a bit better than doing 100% of it. So, but I'm sure that my subconscious was probably wanting me to make the flawed, but also, you know, human, and he could do something good. He wasn't a total monster. And I'll just quickly add, because I know we're running short of time, that what Richard did wasn't that unremarkable. It wasn't that remarkable. Lots of Muslims, Saladin might not have done it because he was quite humane, but most war leaders of the time would have done that, rather than leave 3,000 mouths to feed at your back, men who could have potentially fought against you as well. It's barbaric, but it is actually quite a practical solution to get rid of them. What do you think, Colin, about putting your character in situations where he has to do something hideous?
When I read a book, watch a movie, watch a TV show, I know that if I am not getting into it, not liking it, it's because I don't know who is in that, who in the book or who in the show I'm supposed to like, because that's how I get invested. And I think it's how most people get invested. There's somebody in that book that you like. Otherwise, why would you care what happens to them? So I do start off by trying to make someone, even if they have, like Harry, a lot of baggage, make him underneath a likable person. So when something happens that challenges his, gives him a moral challenge or a choice, I like to think he does make the right one, because I've decided this is who he is. Is it deliberate? For some degree, yes. Yeah, I will look to a situation where I can show that this is my character, as I've chosen the right character to write about. So I'll look for situations where I can show that fairly early on, I think. The other way I do it is, I try to do it, is by making them funny. You can get away with people. People do like funny characters, and I do that as well. But having them in a horrendous situation, I'll think, well, if my character's deep down is a good person, as I've just, you know, as I've pictured them and created them, then what are they going to do in this situation? They're not going to follow the crowd or do something completely hideous. They'll try and find some way to as Ben said, some way to alleviate it.
Yeah. Again, so maybe we should finish on funny, because you both of you are quite humorous in your things, and we've just done a bit of Bleak, so it's still a bit of funny. Again, with Ben, I remember your scene where a Ferdy or a Rufus is caught short, shall we say. You say that was actually from a bit of original research, but was that one? Again, it's kind of like it's a pratfall. It's not a good, as the other thing I noticed with that, one of the early romance scenes between I won't give away who Ferdy's romance is with, he decides to go and chat the lady up, who's not an insignificant lady, outside the privy, effectively. And that struck me as being a humorous thing. You know, it's kind of like, here's a romance, but we're undercutting it a bit. Here's a warrior who's going to, you know, he's just about to take out a really important emir, as it were, but we'll start him off in a funny situation. Again, do you plan your humour in, or is that... I
work very hard at humor, because one of my original novels, an old friend who used to work as my beta reader, he accused me of having no humor in it, said they were too bloody serious, and he was right. And so I try very hard to put in humor now, and it's, as Colin mentioned, you know, it's really good fun, and you know, it's an intimate part of the novel now to try and make people laugh. And that scene where he was caught short, I mean, that, because it was real, it was, I found that hysterically funny to write. What about you, Colin?
But also, it's the banter, pretty teasing about it, isn't it?
I think we people are drawn to humour. I originally, when I first started writing, that's how I made my living, was by writing humour. So I have to have that big red pen come out again, so that I don't overdo it, that it stays in, just on the line and not over it. But I love reading people with a sense of humour. I like to include it in the writing as much as possible.
I think you're being overly modest about the red pen here. But writers do that. Again, I think it's absolutely essential. If you've got a novel, which you do, with lots of dark, you have to have some of the light as well. You have to be able to let your emotion out in a laugh. Anyway, we're coming towards the end, so I just wanted, if you round up, some people say that epic fiction is having a difficult time at the moment. How do you find it? Presumably you're going to stick to your guns and carry on writing epic fiction. Colin, how about you?
Yeah, look, it's working fine for me.
Great.
I will say, I mean, I've been a writer long enough now to see that there's like there's fads and there's it's the different story, different types of novels. They go in waves. Sometimes we had a wave with Tudor fiction. I don't know if that's still as popular now. It does go in waves. So I love doing epic fiction. I couldn't do anything else. So I'm happy where I am. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, same here. I mean, my sales have dropped a lot in the last 5-6 years, like everybody's, but I've branched out. I do a Kickstarter short story every year. I do historical tours as a guide, you know, and I sort of hand sell a lot of books to my readers. I do a lot of other things, but still, you know, writing the novel is the main thing every year, and I don't intend to change that. It's too much fun, and as long as there are people that'll read me, that's what I say to my readers. Thank you for buying my books, and if you keep buying me, I'll keep writing for you.
Yes.
Now, again, I can't see how something that's been in fashion since the very beginning of literature ever could really be out of fashion. But sales is just a weird thing these days. It seems that people, you know, some people are prepared to spend less on a book than they are on a cup of coffee. It doesn't make any sense at all to me, but hopefully that's a hill we'll get over soon.
Indeed.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've come to the end, so I will say thank you very much and farewell.
Okay, thanks, Richard.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. And yeah, thanks, thank Richard. You for watching. Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, Summer Season 2023. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.